I'm Alex Kreiner. I'm a former hedge fund manager and author based in Monaco of a Croatian nationality. And several years ago, in 2017, I published a book titled Grand Deception: The Truth About Bill Browder, the Magnitsky Act, and Anti-Russian Sanctions. And the book was after w the book was banned after about 5 weeks from publishing by Amazon.com, further to a letter written from one Jonathan Weiner, who was the lawyer of the said Bill Browder, about whom my book is. And Jonathan Weiner also used to work as a policy advisor to U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry for, then during Obama administration. So basically, I've published my book Grand Deception, which is in part about Bill Browder, further to his best-selling book named Red Noticed, Red Notice. And I did so basically because I knew a little bit about Bill Browder and about the events he described in Red Notice. And after having read his book, I realized that the whole thing was a big giant pack of lies. And sure enough, that same big giant pack of lies was used to lobby the Magnitsky Act through the US Congress in 2012. And the Magnitsky Act basically is considered as the opening salvo of the new Cold War against Russia.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, how this is also resurfacing after we were told the peace dividend and everything when the Berlin Wall came down in 1989. But what about this guy Bill Browder? Because we've seen him popping up on our TV screens just this week on the Robert Peston show, which is one of the big political shows. I find it a bit unbearable most of the time, actually, but it is for its sins, one of the main political programs of the week. Bill Browder pops up again and again. He's almost like some sort of guru. Apparently, he knows everything about Russian oligarchs. He knows about Russian dodgy money laundering deals, and he's an absolute expert on all this. So, can you just take us into this? This Bill Browder. Who is he, and what is the lie in a nutshell? And how did you overturn the lie? And what's the truth behind it?
Well, I think that presently Bill Browder is the establishment's go-to guy when it comes to demonizing Russia and President Vladimir Putin. Basically, I met Bill Browder in 2005 in Monaco. He used to work as a hedge fund manager in Moscow. He used to run the largest foreign-owned hedge fund in Russia. He was seated by one Edmund Safra, who used to be the owner and CEO of the Republic National Bank of New York. And Bill Browder made a great deal of money in Russia during the 1990s while Russia was transitioning from communism to capitalism. And this whole process was a big mass-scale plunder of Russian wealth and resources in which Bill Browder and his investors participated. And in 2015, I believe, no, sorry, it was in 2005, Bill Browder was kicked out of Russia. So he literally days after he was in Monaco where I had met him, he delivered a presentation invited by the International University of Monaco. I was invited to the event. And literally days after this, he was returning to Russia. And when he arrived in Moscow, his visa was canceled and he was put on the first flight back to London. And he was not allowed to return to Russia anymore. And this was basically the end of his very, very lucrative business in Russia. And he tried very hard to get his visa renewed. He had Tony Blair himself intending to intervene with Vladimir Putin and President Medvedev at the time, and but none of it was successful, and his entry to Russia was banned permanently. Anyway, he turned from one of the most prolific apologists for Vladimir Putin. In fact, he was this presentation that he had in Monaco, where I participated, was the first time I had ever heard anybody speak about Vladimir Putin in positive terms. And very, and when I say positive terms, I mean meaningful positive terms. He was telling about these events in Russia where his fund and his research team would expose corruption in Russian companies like Gazprom, like Yukos, like the government electrical utility and certain banks. And then Putin's government would move in. They would clean up the corruption. They would replace the management team. And so it seemed that Vladimir Putin's government was doing very positive things in the Russian society. Well, after Bill Browder was kicked out of Russia, he became one of the most prolific demonizers of Vladimir Putin and Russia. And so ever since, he's been doing tours around the world, holding presentations and conference panels and so forth. And his big job is basically to demonize Russia and to represent its leadership in the darkest possible light. And this is what his book, Red Notice, is essentially about. A grand self-aggrandizing account of his experience in Russia that leaves Russia looking extremely bad in the eyes of Western readers.
What's the reality behind what he's telling, what the story he's telling there?
It's a very complex story, actually, because it has to do with with a massive fraud that happened through Bill Browder owned companies in Russia, which is unrelated. But in his book, he conflates this story with a legitimate Russian investigation into Bill Browder's own tax dodging, because Bill Browder used certain Russian entities that would normally entitle him to tax credits. So not to bore your listeners too much with the details, but basically he set up these companies in certain regions of Russia where he would benefit from tax, you know, instead of paying 35% tax on his profit, he could pay only 5% tax on his profit, but he would have to employ a certain number of local people who were either disabled or who were veterans of Chechnya war. And he took advantage of these facilities, but he didn't really employ these people. Okay, and so when the Russian authorities investigated, they found that he was not, in fact, entitled to these tax breaks. And instead of then paying his taxes as he was asked to do, Bill Browder actually bankrupted these entities and tried to avoid paying these taxes altogether. And then, you know, from these regions, the tax authority transferred the investigation all the way to Moscow, to the federal level, so he wasn't off the hook. And that's why he was eventually kicked out from Russia. But at the same time, somehow his companies in Russia got stolen. And then the taxes that he did pay on these, what happened is that his companies in Russia got stolen, his Moscow companies got stolen. These were at the time in the early 2000s. There were these corporate raiders, corporate pirates who would steal companies, load them up with debt, and then dump them and walk away with money. So what happened is that Bill Browder's companies paid $230 million in taxes for 2006. Then these companies were stolen. So this is after he was already kicked out of Russia, right? Then the companies were stolen. Then they loaded up the companies with all these expenses that wiped out the profits for 2006. And then they went back to the authorities and said, like, well, in fact, we didn't make any profits in 2006 because we had all these expenses. So the taxes that we paid $230 million worth, we shouldn't have paid. So they applied for a tax refund. And the Russian authorities refunded the $230 million in taxes, in previously paid taxes. Well, Bill Browder claims that this was all done by the rogue actors in the Russian state, by the police and by a confluence of actors from police and tax authorities. Whereas most likely this was not done by the Russians. It was done by people who backed Bill Browder and who were connected with Bill Browder. So it's a very, very complicated story.
Well, let me just intervene slightly there, because I mean, it does sound, just stretching a point, that the police and the Russian authorities would have construed things so as to return a fantastic amount of tax to somebody. You know, why would they do that?
Well, according to Bill Browder, it's because they were the beneficiaries of this tax refund through the companies that they stole from Bill Browder. But there's very good evidence that they never stole the companies from Bill Browder. Okay, and they were simply conducting the investigations into his tax dodging in 2003. So these were two unrelated events. But Bill Browder tried to pin this subsequent tax fraud in 2006 and 2007 on the police, whereas the money actually disappeared offshore through two obscure banks that then, you know, transferred the money abroad and then promptly disappeared. And so, you know, the Russian government is slowly and surely trying to investigate what had happened, but Bill Browder is trying to consistently cover up the tracks, okay? Because he's not the only beneficiary. He's not the only actor. There were a great many bankers and financiers involved in this whole thing. And his partner in Russia was the Israeli-Brazilian banker, Edmund Safra, who ended up killed in Monaco in 1999 under very suspicious circumstances. And then his bank became absorbed by HSBC again under very suspicious circumstances. And then HSBC Bank became Bill Browder's partner in his Russian investments. So there's suspicions that this money was actually stolen along with another at least $600 billion worth of Russian wealth that ended up extracted offshore to Western financial centers. And I think that Bill Browder's job now is to try to obstruct all of Russia's attempt to investigate and recover these assets by introducing these Magnitsky Acts in Western jurisdictions that make it next to impossible for Russians to conduct investigations in London, in Switzerland, in Cyprus, in the United States, in Canada, wherever, you know, the money was disappearing to, and to sanction individuals who are involved in these investigations.
Well, that's right. That sounds fascinating, because we don't get any of that in the coverage here. According to our media, Bill Browder is someone who's a financial bigwig who was wronged by Putin, and he's knows all of the tricks that Putin will play and the Russians will play. And also he has been, as you said, quite obviously behind these Magnitsky Acts. So the point here seems to me to be to put Russian business people who are wanting to do deals with the West, at least another aspect to it all, into a very difficult position, Alex, so that when they travel trying to do deals, whether it's to sell Russian gas, Russian manufactured goods, make trade links with the West, or anywhere that these acts are instituted, that they are always very nervous, tentative, that they may be have their visas revoked at any time, and they may have all their assets seized. So it's much less likely that they would venture actually physically into countries like Switzerland or Monaco or London, come to London to actually try and make these deals. It's almost a way of intimidating any Russian entrepreneur, business person away from the West.
Well, in a way, maybe you may have a point, but you know, like very often these Russian entrepreneurs who come to the West, to Monaco, to London, and so forth, are already kind of, you know, Russian fifth column. They're loyal to Western centers of power, so they're not generally going to have any trouble so long as they are well behaved. Usually the people that they target, and the way this is done, you know, one thing to understand about these Magnitsky acts, that they're an abomination to Western legal systems, because they do not include any kind of a due process, right? So let's say that if some person in an unnamed person in the United States Treasury Department decides that they don't like Tony Gosling, they can put you on the Magnitsky list, and then you're sanctioned by the United States government, and there's nothing you can do about it. There's no recourse. Okay, so this is a purely bureaucratic punitive measure with no recourse and no due process. And one of the, you know, like one of the ways that's because one thing that your listeners should understand is that Bill Browder's narrative seems interesting at first blush, but it is very, very exceedingly easy to poke holes through it. It's really a house of cards. And the giveaway is that Bill Browder generally only appears under strictly controlled conditions in panels where he'll only be asked very friendly questions. And the public is always thoroughly vetted by his office. And, you know, when you had somebody like you have an investigative reporter in the United States. Her name is Lucy Commissar. She wrote a number of pieces on Bill Browder, and when she wanted to participate in one of his events in New York a few years ago in 2015, I think they wouldn't let her. She could not come in front of him and ask him any questions. Only the people who have no clue are allowed, or people who are very friendly and ask pre-vetted questions. His story doesn't hold water at all. And I think that his utility to the Western establishment, the UK establishment right now, especially with the events going on in Ukraine, is that he is the go-to guy for demonizing Russia and Vladimir Putin.
Yeah, and he's got basically a credible story, so long as you don't really scratch the surface. But what about what's been going on this week? We've seen this actually quite a surprise. It was a surprise to me. Was it a surprise to you to see Russian troops actually moving into the Kiev-controlled parts of Ukraine?
Yes, I must say I was quite surprised. I didn't expect it. I thought that the Russians would wait out the West, because you know, the financial economic crisis in the West is about to blow up. Ukraine itself is at the verge of economic collapse. And I thought that the Russians could achieve their goals without a shot being fired. Not only that, but them actually moving troops into Ukraine kind of helped the West close ranks against the Russians, and it bolstered the anti-Russian narrative in the West. Whereas if they didn't attack, that wouldn't have happened. Generally speaking, I have noticed that Russian leadership hasn't been acting in an impulsive way in their conduct of foreign policy. So I must assume that they have wargamed the present activities very thoroughly, and that they must have made some kind of a cost-benefit analysis to where they decided that the current action actually makes sense for them. But because I was wrong in predicting that they wouldn't attack, then their cost-benefit analysis is not clear to me. I don't really know what's going to happen. But generally, Europe is in trouble. The energy, this is going to massively exacerbate the energy crisis in Europe, not only for this winter, but probably for the next one as well. And the pain will be mostly felt by the West, I believe. Russia is now number one crude oil exporter to the United States. So the United States is not entirely immune to the fallout from this crisis.
What do you think, though, that's led to this? Some people saying, for example, that back in December, the Russian made their four demands in a draft treaty to the US, saying, look, if you want, we want security in Eastern Europe, if you want security in Eastern Europe too. And it sent them to the United States, which was interesting, because it does imply that the US is the major senior partner when it comes to European military affairs. Saying that they want these various guarantees, things like these hotlines. They want guarantees that Ukraine is not going to join NATO, and that the troops that are already in some of the NATO countries like Poland and the Baltic states should be removed. Foreign troops in those countries should be removed, which is actually, you know, perfectly feasible within the NATO system. You don't have to have foreign troops in NATO countries, because the idea is that if one of those countries is invaded, then the other troops can come to its assistance. It doesn't mean to say that you have to have British troops hanging around in the United States all the time, or in Poland, or anywhere else, or American troops come to that. So a lot of people are saying that, well, because the Americans ignored this, it's a draft treaty from December, but slowly but surely the Russians, particularly the leadership and the military, have said, well, we just cannot guarantee our security, and so we're going to have to move into Ukraine and basically decapitate the state and make sure that that we are not threatened at all by Ukraine.
Okay, so the Russians sent two draft treaties, one to the United States and one to the NATO. And my understanding is that a number of their points, there was some flexibility to some of their demands, but there was no flexibility to their demand that Ukraine could never, ever become a member of NATO. That was their red line. And that was also the demand that was denied by both the United States and NATO, because they suddenly invented this principle that NATO is open to foreign countries who, if they want to accede and become members of NATO, then and if NATO member states agree, then any country can become a member of NATO, which is absurd, because that's not what the NATO treaty actually says. And another thing that people have to appreciate is that this is not like a Boy Scout club. NATO is a protection racket type organization, and they don't. It's not like you fill in an accession form and then they interview you and then they say, like, okay, you can come in. It takes years and years of preparations. And when Croatia was a becoming member of the NATO, we had for many years NATO instructors and troops inside of Croatia preparing. And one of the things that happened is that your military intelligence becomes a part of NATO. They take control of that part of your society and the secret services in the country. So there's years and years of preparations. And so the NATO has had something like 10,000 instructors in Ukraine since 2013. They have been they created these training centers all over Ukraine, where they train not only the troops but also Ukraine's diplomats, public servants, and journalists. Okay, and so there's this big, strong lobbying push within this country to make sure that it becomes a member of NATO, or at the very least an ally. And in Ukraine's case, the whole purpose was to turn Ukraine into a bludgeon to use to destabilize Russia eventually. And for the Russians, this was clear, because when they held their military exercises, they would create these training facilities, but the training facilities would then turn into military bases that could be occupied by NATO in the future, and which could be a basis for offensive to house offensive arsenal of weaponry targeted at Russia. So it was out of the question for Russia to just passively sit and wait to see what happens, because over the last two centuries, Russia has been invaded on three occasions from the Western centers of power, you know, with the Napoleonic Wars and then the Crimean Wars and then the Operation Barbarossa in 1940 in World War II in 1941. So Russians cannot look at this, you know, enlargement of NATO and piling up weaponry and troops along Russia's western borders and then just take NATO's word for it that they are not intended as a threat to Russia, because ultimately the NATO and the United States gave Russia only the option to take them at their word. This is not a threat to you. You shouldn't be worried about your security just because we're training the Nazi battalions in Ukraine, bringing more weaponry and piling up arsenal of offensive weaponry all along your western borders, eastern borders.
A couple of very undiplomatic things have happened, haven't they? So one was the response to the draft treaty for security in Eastern Europe was to actually start to pile in more and more weapons to Ukraine. I mean, this is British anti-tank weapons and, you know, basically every NATO country helping to contribute to this in one way or another. You know, pouring weapons in is not a very good way to respond to an attempt to get a security treaty to de-escalate things. And then the other thing is, I understand Volodymyr Zelensky, the Ukrainian president, was talking yesterday about potentially having to go back to using nuclear weapons in as part of the Ukrainian armed forces. And obviously this is not going to go down well in Moscow.
Yes, I think that was a very foolish thing for him to say. And he probably, I bet you anything, he regrets having said that. But I think that just came out as in desperation. I think that today Ukraine is in serious trouble. Among many Ukrainians, there's a very heavy resentment towards the role that the United States and NATO have played, and the United Kingdom.
But I mean, hang on, because to be fair, there's also a big resentment against Russia in Ukraine, hence quite a lot of people joining these neo-Nazi groups.
Well, actually, no, it's not quite a lot. You know, these neo-Nazis, they are loud and shrill, but they're not very numerous. Politically, they're insignificant. They're just very loud, and they demonstrate and they make these shows of force, but they're not a very significant political force, you know, in the sense that they are a large part of this large segment of Ukrainian society. That's not the case. There's a genuine, real patriotism among the people of Ukraine and a genuine desire to stay independent. But this whole adventure with, you know, we're going to become part of the EU, we're going to become a part of NATO, has turned out to be a cruel joke on them, because it became very obvious that neither one of those things were seriously entertained by the West. And instead, they were just left there, goaded on to start some kind of a conflict with Russia that would only cost, Ukrainian blood, Ukrainian sacrifice. And when things got serious, the Western military instructors, the Western diplomats, they all just packed up and left. So they left Ukraine on its own. They made it clear that if Ukraine gets into a military conflict against Russia, that they wouldn't help militarily with troops and weaponry. And so there's a great deal of resentment in Ukraine against the Western powers.
Okay, so what's your understanding of, I mean, we're talking actually on the invasion day, which is the Thursday, the 24th of February, 2022. What's your understanding as to militarily what's happened today? You know, maybe what parts of Ukraine are now the Russians are now at the end of the day have got hold of?
Well, that's a very tricky question. Apparently, it's a lot worse than we thought initially, because I thought initially, you know, the morning's news was that they were just pushing away Ukrainian army units from the Donetsk front lines so that they couldn't continue shelling the Donetsk and Lugansk.
Well, that's right. I mean, let's just make it clear. Donetsk and Lugansk, these two breakaway regions, not the entire region, was actually controlled by the breakaway republics. There was a quite a large slice north of both of those areas, which was actually controlled by the Kiev forces. And so what you're saying is that they're pushing it back to the original line.
Yes, that's correct. But Russia's recognition of these two regions recognizes them in their administrative borders, meaning the full extent of the territory, both the breakaway regions and the part that's controlled by the Kiev government. And that also includes the port city of Mariupol. Okay. And then, in addition, there have been precision strikes launched against other military facilities across Ukraine that would turn make communications for Ukrainian military extremely difficult. So they've rendered those units blind in the east of the country, but. Then the Russians also took over the Chernobyl, the city of Chernobyl, and that part of the country. And so, the last report I got from Kiev from a friend of mine who's in Kiev, he said that Kiev is now a sitting duck, essentially, as a result of today's military action of the Russians. So what's going to happen next is I couldn't begin to predict. But basically, this morning, President Putin gave a very short press conference in which he made four points. One of them is that Ukraine had to be demilitarized. So that's part of the action today. Ukraine had to recognize Crimea as a Russian territory. They had to deal directly with the leadership of the Donetsk and Luhansk Republic, and they had to give up their intent to join the NATO. So those four demands were pronounced by Vladimir Putin today at his very short press conference. But the only part that wasn't given as a choice to Ukraine government was the part of them having to be demilitarized and turned into a neutral country. And so apparently this is what the full extent of Russian military intervention could entail.
Surely this is going to mean a change of government. Surely the Russians are going to do that. They're not going to just simply allow a government to continue that is extremely hostile to Moscow.
I don't know. Zelensky's government was already on very thin ice even before this intervention. Whether the Russians are going to topple the government and install a new one, or whether they're going to maybe just force Zelensky to deal with the breakaway regions, which would be political death for Vladimir Zelensky, which would then probably necessitate new elections and who knows what. I cannot even begin to guess what's going to be the fallout from this.
What do you think is going through Victoria Nuland's mind today?
I don't know, but I think that if I were Victoria Nuland, I would regret my project from 2014, because that was a very short-sighted, pyrrhic victory for the neocons in the United States.
Yeah, I mean, because, some will be saying, well, what's happened today? Why didn't Putin do that back in 2014? I wonder if you think that actually what's happened in Moscow is that they've become actually a lot more confident and more capable since then.
Yeah, that's true. Their alliance with China has become a lot tighter and a lot more solid. They know that they have China behind their back, backing them. I mean, they have solidified their position with Belarus and Kazakhstan and Azerbaijan. I think that they're facing a less volatile situation in Georgia. And so I think that this time around, Russia is feeling a lot more confident. And I mean, to do what they've done today, they must feel extraordinarily confident. This is a very risky operation that they've done, because, you know, with military confrontation, things can go off track. You cannot predict all the outcomes.
No, you certainly can't. I just wonder if, you know, they're looking at the situation. Well, if we leave the Ukraine as it is, or as it was yesterday, to carry on for very much longer, then it may not be reversible. But at this point, maybe particularly, at the moment, it is reversible and we can take some military action. But if we were to leave it much longer, then Ukraine would be a much too tough nut to crack.
Yeah, I'm not sure I understood your question, but I think it's not going to be easy this time. I think that there are some of the reports I heard is that Russians are going to insist on investigations of war crimes that happened in Odessa and apparently in the Mariupol regions. Some extraordinarily ugly things happened, and that they will insist on something similar to Nuremberg war crimes tribunals for those who are found guilty of war crimes for things that happened in 2014. So it doesn't look like they're going to be leaving just like that.
No. Anyway, look, Alex, can you just tell listeners where they can get hold of your book on Bill Browder, which is at the sort of economic warfare end of this particular battle?
Yeah, well, my book on Bill Browder only has two chapters on Bill Browder. The remaining four are about generally the broader historical context and nature of the conflict between Russia and the West. And it was banned on Amazon, so it's not available there. It is available from the pages of Red Pill Press, which was the only publisher brave enough to publish the book after it was banned by Amazon twice, actually. And so it's redpillpress.com, and the book title is Grand Deception, The Truth About Bill Browder, The Magnitsky Act, and Anti-Russian Sanctions. And people can find me on Twitter at Naked Hedgie.
Okay, Alex Craner, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony. Always a pleasure.